Okay. So no comments, questions? Yeah. So I talked about what the malicious software is, and I implied that we had ways of spreading, ways of getting on systems, ways of doing more than we should do on systems. In particular, I talked about malware, which like spreads via the network. So obviously, I'm not supposed to be able to just, you know, sit next to your computer and over the wireless install something on your computer. That shouldn't happen. And we call mechanisms which let that happen vulnerabilities. So if I can do that to your system, there's some software on there where there's some unintended behavior that's letting me do things that is not supposed to happen. And we can speak of this broadly. You can think of Trojans as a case where the vulnerability is that there's some user who's going to open that file you give them. But when we talk about software vulnerabilities, it's completely automated. That I'm not supposed to be able to go to a web server and install an executable on the web server as just someone using the website. But if I can, that's a software vulnerability in the web server. And there are lots of kinds of software vulnerabilities. And in this class, we're going to spend a lot of time on one of these, and that's memory safety bugs. So these are problems with pointers. There's all sorts of ways you can not do pointers right. You can, you know, make a pointer to something outside an array. You can have a pointer to nowhere that because you freed something and didn't get rid of the pointer to it. There's all these sorts of things where you can do things which are invalid in pointers. And yeah, so who here has done something like that? Who here has had code using pointers that does something wrong? And anyone willing to volunteer, what happened when you did this? Segfault. So segfault's the universal answer. And that's actually not so bad. If our programs just segfaulted every time we did something bad with pointers, as a software vulnerability, it doesn't do very much. You know, if I can make your web server segfault all the time, I can take down your website. But I can't really do much else. You had a question? Yeah. Yeah, so you also just get junk values. That's another, you know, perfectly innocent. If you just got a actually random value, that would be perfectly fine. Now, the problem is that, first of all, when you get a random value because you accessed a bogus pointer, it's not really a random value. It's a value of, you know, something in memory that's deterministic and maybe related to things the program was doing. Maybe it's the value of something important. Maybe it's some secret information. That could be the case. Similarly, when you get a segfault, that means you accessed memory that you weren't supposed to. But you were accessing some random memory address, and if you access something that wasn't so random with your error, maybe you'd cause problems. Maybe you'd change an important value of your application, like who the current user is. And this is something that, in fact, is usually true when you have a memory safety bug. So for a lot of memory safety bugs, it turns out that if I'm controlling the input which triggers that bug, I can choose what the values of, say, your bogus pointer are, or what you write to memory that you're not supposed to use, that might actually be used for something that happens to be near whatever you messed up your pointer arithmetic on. And this means that a surprising portion of those memory safety bugs are actually software vulnerabilities. That a clever attacker, and we'll talk about the techniques used to do that later in the semester, can churn that innocent looking memory safety bug, which in your experience typically just causes a segfault or some junk to be printed out, and turn it into a way to run whatever they want in your program. And because it's so easy to make these memory safety bugs, this is has been a big problem for all sorts of software. So, have any of you written a piece of software which uses pointers and you're confident doesn't have a memory safety bug? Yeah, so very few people. So that's why it's been such a big issue over the years. So we're gonna talk about techniques for exploiting these memory safety bugs. And there's been this little cat and mouse game we're gonna go through where people come up with these generic defenses where you don't actually fix the programs, but you make it harder for the memory safety bug to turn into something really bad. So we'll talk about that, like the defenses, what attackers did in replace of it and still managed to exploit the bugs. And we'll also try to talk a little bit about ways of very systematically avoiding these memory safety bugs, at least enough that you don't have security problems. So that's the biggest category and what we're going to spend most of our time on, of course. And since this deals with pointers, we're going to be doing a lot of low-level stuff. You should be comfortable with that. You should be comfortable with like assembly and machine code and memory layout and things like that. So another example of a common class of bugs are injection bugs, things from type confusion. So the classic example is that who here knows SQL? Seen SQL? So most people have seen SQL. So in SQL, you have a quoted string. A common way to write quickly your web application is to take a string from the user, insert it in the middle of that quoted string, and send that as a SQL query. And if you do this, the user can put a quote in there and turn it into both the name in a SQL query and some SQL commands to send to the server. I call this type confusion because it's something which is supposed to be just a string and it turns into a command. And this occurs in other contexts. So there used to be some CGI scripts, some website stuff that would take user input and put it in a shell command, something to run on a command line, and put it in quotes because that just the same as you do with SQL, and that's obviously really bad because it ends up being that you put a quote in there and then you put semicolon and whatever commands you want to run on the server. This is a real common error, and it occurs in other contexts. Just whenever you have this case where you can take one value and have it be interpreted in the wrong way. So if you took 30 through 30 with last semester, we talked about undefined behavior. So if you don't know, if you didn't, undefined behavior in C is where the people who wrote the C standard decided they're not going to specify what actually happens. And in undefined behavior, one thing is accessing pointers you're not supposed to. That's undefined behavior. The C standard people decided the compiler doesn't need to figure out how to make that work and can just do whatever's convenient. And what's convenient ends up being just letting you access outside the ends of an array and things like that. But another thing that's undefined behavior is integer overflow and underflow. They're for signed integers, and for unsigned, it wraps around. And both of these things are usually not what you're expecting. If you take a large number, multiply it by 4, your code usually expects to get a larger number. But sometimes you'll get a smaller number. And this turns out sometimes to be also a security bug. Something where a very clever attacker, it depends on the circumstance, can turn into something where they can run whatever code they want. The most common way this would happen is that you do have that larger number turn into a smaller number, and then you pass that smaller number to, say, malloc. And now you have your integer overflow gets turned into an array out of bounds bug, and that's much easier to exploit. So there are also much sort of simpler classes of vulnerabilities. So one is just simply not checking your input for things. Like some naive web servers had problems like this. So who knows what dot dot slash means? You can describe what you went to, sorry? Yeah, so the parent directory. So some web servers didn't check properly for dot dot slash. Usually you have to do something a little more complicated, but you could sometimes access this URL, not in a web browser, but more directly, and get at files that are outside what the web server is supposed to give you access to. And that's pretty bad. That's just not checking your input. So there's bugs which are that simple. And another common class is Synchronization bugs. So commonly in real systems, you'll read a file, then do something with the file. So let's say I have a program which, you give it a file name, and I say, first look at that file and say, is that file readable by you? If not, then I'm going to do something with it. Well, what you can do is you can pass me a file that's not readable by me, then remove that file and make a new one, and I violated that contract. So this is sort of, I check something, check some security property, like is the file readable by some user? Is the file owned appropriately? Is the file an executable? So I check something to make sure I don't do something dangerous, and then I do it. And often it turns out that a user can exploit this race condition. They can race ahead and try to, after I check and before I do it, change that condition I was checking. This is a common class of bugs, especially in things like operating systems, where a user can easily write in code to do that racing, where the operating system's checking whether something's executable when you make a system call and then doing something. You can make the system call and have another program you're running change the file and try to hopefully get in that little gap. Yes? Yes, most will. And most of them got at least this much done. So I'm giving this as a sort of an illustrative example. Only very simple web servers, which probably were never production, had got this wrong. But there were real bugs. For example, Apache at one time had a bug where you couldn't do quite this, but the way it kept itself from serving files in outside of its specified directory is that it looked for a particular pattern, and you could put a percent something, and it would confuse it, and it would still access that parent directory, just not doing the checking properly. But this illustrates, I have this example, which is simpler than would actually work, to illustrate the sort of concept that the web server is not meant to do that, and probably would have some checking to do it. Though I would note, ordinarily, if you type this into a web browser, the web browser won't send this request, because of the way web browsers usually resolve URLs. They'll get rid of the dot dot slashes first. But obviously, if you're writing your own web client, you can do that. You can send whatever you want. Okay. So any questions about vulnerabilities in general? Okay, so we have all these classes of vulnerabilities. We'll probably be spending most of our time on memory stuff, and we might spend a little time on a few other categories. So talked about vulnerabilities. There's also the word exploit. An exploit is what we give to something which uses a vulnerability. So we will be producing exploits and some homework assignments in this class so you can learn how vulnerabilities work and why they're so dangerous. And I think this is absolutely necessary because when you look at things like array over out of bounds, things which have only caused you set faults in the past and haven't seen how you actually manipulate that to do something useful, it's often hard to believe that it's actually really possible or that easy. It seems far-fetched to people. And a lot of people in industry, when you tell them they have a software vulnerability, if you don't show them some sort of exploit, they're not going to really believe it's bad. They're going to think, that's pretty contrived. But it usually turns out that someone who knows what they're doing can produce at least a proof of concept that shows, yes, this is a real exploit, and it's really dangerous. So for example, a common way to do that is to open up the calculator program. So for example, if you visit a website and then your calculator opens up, that you're pretty sure that that's not supposed to happen, but it's at least as a proof of concept because it's clearly not doing anything dangerous. And it's demonstrating that the attacker could have opened up some much worse program. That's a common way that professionals will show people, yes, you really have a vulnerability in your software. Okay. So any questions about vulnerabilities, exploits? so let's go to a question. So what language do you think malware is written in, or in general? What would be your guesses as the most popular necessary things? Yeah. C? Okay, other guesses, thoughts?
Assembly.
Assembly. So what, any reasoning behind that?
No.
Okay. Any other ideas? Yeah? Scripting languages? Okay, so you have lots of possibilities, and I mentioned scripting languages like macro languages as a gimme. And yeah, there's lots of things you can write malware in. You could write malware in pretty much any programming language. But some of the things, like exploiting memory vulnerabilities, basically requires writing assembly language and probably even machine code. So exploiting those vulnerabilities, because we need to put whatever the processor can execute in our exploit, we need to write machine code or write assembly language and convert it to machine code. And need to know very precisely what that machine code looks like, because this is going to affect how we construct that exploit. So parts of malware are going to need to be written in assembly language and machine code. It also turns out that a lot of what malware does, in addition to doing its evil thing and exploiting software vulnerabilities, is hiding from anti-malware tools. And there are ways of doing this with machine code and assembly language which are probably a little more effective than if you tried to do it with a scripting language. So malware also written in high-level scripting languages. If you want to create an exploit, that's a great thing to do. It's nice and fast to code. You probably don't really care about maintaining your piece of malware over the years. So it's common to see sort of non-machine code parts written in as high-level scripting language or C, depending on how people want to distribute it. So there's these little pieces which are going to need machine code hacking, but the rest doesn't need to be written that way. It's also worth noting that malware has its own set of specialized tools. So people have written tools specifically for writing malware. So virus construction kit is the name of a particular piece of software someone distributed for making viruses. So there are specialized sort of programming tools for constructing malware. That's our sort of bevy of languages. So it's all the languages, but there's a lot of machine code stuff for some of these exploits. And if you're exploiting a scripting language, there's scripting language stuff to exploit that scripting language. You want to, you know, if you're running SQL commands, you need to write stuff in SQL. If you're running shell commands, you need to write stuff in shell, if that's what your exploit does. So we alluded to ways that malware spreads when we talked about categories of malware. So, and that's sort of one of the big ways we characterize malware, just because that's how we're going to defend against it. So we had viruses that embed themselves in other programs. And embedding yourself in other programs is a way to spread, that people are going to share those programs. This is not so common today, but it used to be pretty ubiquitous in the 80s and 90s, that you take a floppy from someone. Who here knows what a floppy is? Hopefully, good, okay. Don't know how old I am. You take a floppy from someone, put it in your computer, you start up DOS, and run the program on that floppy. That was a common way for malware to spread. Also with shared files, if you can embed it in some ordinary looking file. So viruses sort of have their own propagation mechanism where it's pretty obvious how things work. And when you have vulnerabilities in network accessible services, that's another way things can spread. So viruses and worms commonly would spread by finding a vulnerability in something that runs on a network. So this is usually not targeting your personal computer, but usually like a web server. If a web server has a vulnerability, you can make a virus or a worm that spreads to all the web servers in the world with that vulnerability. And this is a very, very effective way to get on lots of machines, and to do it without user intervention. So also, there's non-obvious things. So usually you don't think of sharing executables, but for example, you share media. It's common for USB sticks to support auto-running an application when you put them in. This at least used to be a Windows feature. So there were worms that would spread by setting themselves as that auto-run executable on a USB stick. Whenever you inserted a new USB stick in an infected machine, they would copy themselves to that. And that would be how they'd spread. And one you've probably seen is email attachment. So here has gotten a virus email. That few people. I guess our spam filtering is better these days. So this used to be a huge problem. Like front page of the New York Times, huge problem. But I guess not anymore. But that's a common way to spread. So malware would send emails to people with an attachment, which was the malware. This was a common way for worms to spread, especially in the early 2000s. And it's a very good way to spread very wide and also annoy lots of people because they get all these spam emails that are, you know, kind of look like something to open. And doesn't actually accomplish that much because it's pretty obvious that people have done it. And probably the most modern way is websites and browser vulnerabilities. So just like web servers might have a vulnerability, sometimes web browsers have vulnerabilities. And the biggest case are things like Adobe Flash and JavaScript have been pretty bad at not having vulnerabilities in the past. So these have commonly had ways where a malicious website at some point could run code. And this is a way that people would install malware in machines. So any other kinds of ways malware spreads that I missed here that people think are important? Yeah. Yeah, so there's just phishing, like sending out spam to spread your malware. I don't know that's how it's commonly done for malware. And phishing is really just about collecting the information you put in, usually. I'm sure that's always true. But yes, that seems like a way people might spread malware. Yeah?
I've heard,
Okay, so Bluetooth. So I guess, I haven't looked into that, but I guess there's probably, you can request to send a file and see if people will install it. That's certainly viable. Yeah?
I think like the cracked versions of programs.
Oh yeah, so I didn't mention Trojans here, but yeah. So your fake useful software, like your cracked version of Adobe Photoshop, that is actually, you know, 1 kilobyte of malware and 26 gigabytes of nothing. Okay, any other categories I missed? Okay, so talked a lot about malware, and this course is defense against the dark arts, so we're gonna talk about defenses. So what are some defenses against malware? Yeah.
Common sense,
okay.
Firewall,
yeah. Any others? Yeah.
Like spam filters.
Spam filters, yeah. Antivirus software. I'm surprised that that's that late, but not disappointed. Okay, so we have these defenses. So one thing is that we can attack ways that this malware spreads. So spam filters, one of the things they do these days is filter out malware from your email attachments. So good functionality for that. Firewalls can make sure that, you know, if you don't need to have that network accessible service accessible, it's not accessible. So if it's not your web server that's vulnerable, but your file server, maybe your file server doesn't need to be accessible from all over the world. That can help. And then there's this human training, so for malware which somehow exploits something that people are tempted to do that can choose not to. I would note as a philosophical side argument that I would argue most of the time when we have, when you do something that causes something bad to happen in your computer, we as computer scientists should look at this and say, not that the user screwed up, but that some programmer screwed up somewhere. This is not always the philosophy people take, but I think it's a good way to try to think about these things, since it's often very confusing, and it shouldn't be. And the big one, which is antivirus software, which is probably one of the big reasons why we call everything viruses. So antivirus software is software which theoretically tries to keep you from having viruses. As you will see later in this class, I perhaps don't have that high of an opinion of antivirus software, but it's very important and a big part of why malware looks the way it does. So there's other sorts of defenses we see out there that people didn't mention some of. So one are things like app stores and other filtering of what applications you can run on your machine. So for example, on OS X, Apple requires developer registration unless you flip an obscure setting in system preferences to run executables. If you don't, you get something like this. Whenever you run an executable that isn't signed by a registered developer. And in theory, Apple can even blacklist developers that have gone bad. So maybe this can help keep people from having malware because, you know, even if the malware developer can register, hopefully you can find them fast enough. And it turns out registering with Apple costs real money. So it's probably not something you're going to keep doing over and over and over and over again. Another thing is you can sandbox software. That, you know, not all your software needs to have access to your taxes to encrypt them and lock them away from you. You know, if you're just playing a game, you don't need it to access your taxes. And you know, we can, you know, do that today. We see that on phones pretty ubiquitously. When you install a phone application, not all your applications get access to all your things. You get these permission dialogues at some point, asking you whether you want to let it do that. And if it's something which is not supposed to access that, you can stop it. And there's some hope that maybe at some point in the future, you know, we'll have this sort of granularity and hopefully better granularity for protecting your desktop applications. So you don't have to worry about something broken in your game, you know, changing your homework. So these are sort of developing defenses. That is what like big operating system manufacturers are focusing on to deal with malware. And probably also for some more ulterior motives that are less benevolent. So we mentioned spam filters. So another big malware defense is in web browsers. So I mentioned web browsers are a big way that malware spreads these days. That by exploiting something broken in a web browser or a web browser extension like Adobe Flash or Java. And the big defense that browser manufacturers use for this is blacklists. So Chrome and Firefox use what the Google Safe Browsing List. So Google maintains this big list of malicious websites. And they update it periodically, and they just have it something that your web browser can download as this big blob, which has shortened forms so it can easily look them up of all these malicious websites. So when you visit a malicious website, instead of going to that website, you got this, what they call an interstitial, you get a dialogue which says, this website is dangerous. And maybe with some really well-hidden option to proceed. And Microsoft does something similar. They call theirs Microsoft Smart Screen. So these both work by having people scanning the web for malicious websites and adding them to these blacklists. This is a way to defend users against malware. So A big theme of this course is that there's this cat and mouse game where people will try to do things against malware and malware authors will react. And there are a bunch of things that malware authors will do against. And the biggest one, the most ubiquitous one perhaps, and we'll talk about more later in the semester, but the simplest thing is that they'll try to make their malware hard to read, make it different, make it harder to detect via these mechanisms. Make it blend in with normal things. They'll try all these sorts of techniques, and we'll talk about them in more detail later, that are targeted at these anti-malware techniques. And this also explains why the techniques look the way they do. So a reason why operating system manufacturers like this sort of developer registration mechanism is that it's hard to defeat by making your malware look different each time. You don't have a blacklist. But if you have something like a blacklist, you just make a new website. That's not hard to do. So that's less effective, but there's not really much you can do about that. So any questions about malware defenses, counter defenses at this sort of high level? Okay, so I'm going to go through some history. Start with this. So this is the front page of the New York Times. And this is when malware made it big. This is 1988. And we see that maybe the second most prominent place in the play, we have this article about a virus in military computers. So this was the Morris worm, named after its author. And this was in the early internet, which at the time was largely, but not entirely, a military network. It also had a military and academic network, essentially. And Morris created this worm, which spread, which was called a virus at the time even, which is what I'm saying, ubiquitous term, which spread to practically all the big systems connected to the internet at the time. And caused big problems because it produced a whole lot of network traffic. It was actually intended to be stealthier than that, but Morris made a mistake. And it didn't stop itself from trying to spread, so it consumed all these resources trying to spread to all these other machines, and that's why it was both disruptive and noticed. And who knows what, happened to Morris? Who can guess what happened to Morris? So, probably arrested, and that's a good guess. Did not turn out well for Morris. And Morris, it turned out, was a Cornell graduate student who decided that he would like to use the computer resources all across the internet. But it caused a lot of problems. And yeah, did not turn out well for him. But this was the first big case of viruses in the public consciousness, not the absolute first one. I believe this was after War Games. If you know it, War Games is a movie which is credited with being part of the reason we have the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And also is very good to see if you want to see movies about how people viewed computers in the 80s. And the Morris worm worked so well because it was actually pretty clever. So Morris found vulnerabilities in mail servers, so email servers, and a service for getting information about a user called FingerD, where you look up a user on a system and find out, what their office was, telephone number, things like that. Sort of you didn't have web pages at the time, and this was a common way to look up information on someone. And at the time, SendMail was maybe not the only mail server in existence, but probably pretty close. So this spread everywhere. It also had other ways of spreading. So it spread through RSH and RxEC, which are predecessors to SSH. So when it infected a user, it also logged into all the machines the user could log into with the equivalent of SSH and infected those. And it tried to hide. So it used this primitive mechanism for hiding, which is, you know, still works pretty well today, which is that it just had a funny name. It was called SH. SH is the name of the default shell. So when someone looking at executables just thought, oh, someone has a login shell. That looks perfectly normal. And so it was hard for system administrators to find. And I mentioned obfuscation, so they make it harder to analyze, though this didn't turn out to be much of an issue for the multiple teams of people at major universities which were mobilized by having their systems be broken. The strings in the binary were slightly obscure. So you couldn't just look for strings in the binary and hope to get that. Like I said, yeah, this was a case where most of his problems were that he had this code to try and avoid reinfecting machines, but it didn't actually work correctly. It didn't properly detect that a machine was already infected and stop trying to spread. And that's what made it run way out of control. So that's a very old example of sort of poorly engineered malware. And I also like to give a more modern example malware. Perhaps sort of the on like the higher other end of the scale, which is Stuxnet. So Stuxnet was a piece of malware that targeted Iranian nuclear enrichment facilities. And it targeted control computers for centrifuges in those enrichment facilities and physically damaged them. So it sent commands to those centrifuges to cause them to do something that would damage the centrifuge, and also tried to hide to the operators that this was happening. And it spread via USB sticks because these systems were not connected to the internet. So they needed a way to spread. And it was publicly known in 2010 and deployed in 2009. And it's widely believed to be developed by the US and Israeli government. There's obviously no official acknowledgement of that, but according to many press reports. This is an example of a very different kind of malware, which was very stealthy and probably did what it was intended to do. Sort of the more modern incarnation of this. This is big malware in the news. So earlier, someone mentioned Adware. So now in between these two extremes. So we have one extreme where someone was trying to get extra CPU cycles apparently and screwed up. And we have the other end where state actors were trying to do something which would traditionally be like spy sabotage stuff with malware. And we have the in-between. We have Adware, which is trying to give you more ads, which is bad, but not, you know, bad and well thought out, but not the same thing. And, you know, the problem with, you know, trying to run your business based on ads is that you need a web page to display the ads. And the idea that Adware generally has is, hey, why don't we just make the browser make all web pages display our ads? It's a good solution for us. And commonly, this has been bundled with legitimate software. This is this app potentially unwanted programs category I talked about earlier. And it's surprisingly common. And so this is an example of what Adware looks like. This is a little busier than Amazon's normal page. This is from a paper by Google, an example. And this is surprisingly ubiquitous. So in 2014, Google published, 2015, I think, Google published a study with data from 2014, and they found that 5% of clients accessing Google had Adware, which is surprisingly high. And over 90% of them were using code from a venture capital-backed company called Superfish, which, according to Crunchbase, had $19.3 million in investment. And according to Forbes, $38 million in revenue, and then disappeared after this became public because of a well-publicized incident you may remember from 2015 where Lenovo was bundling superficial software. But apparently there's a new similar venture, according to TechCrunch, which TechCrunch, if you don't know, is a source of biased news about Silicon Valley if you want one. But as biased as in they probably don't read too far from the press releases. But if you want to know about what startups are happening, it's a good source. So this is surprisingly big business, and it's that sort of gray area where some people might not say it's malware because it was sort of installed legitimately. And that this is a big way to make money off malware, which is some topic I'd like to get to. So we had sort of a case where Morris was making no money. We had the case where the motivation for the malware was the direct effects of the sabotage. And here we have a case where there's a lot of money involved, and apparently they're making money off this malware, and you know, at least in tens of millions of dollars. That there's a revenue source, and the revenue source is displaying ads. And many of the other things we talked about at the beginning of class are ways you can make money. So people mentioned stealing credentials, like passwords and credit card numbers. That's a way you can make money. So there's markets where you can say, get your big dump of credit card numbers with CVVs and sell them. And here are some examples of prices. You might be surprised how low these prices are. Yes, you can pay 10 bucks for a credit card with a CVV. That's about the market rate. And the main reason I bring this up is because they are so low. Or 15 bucks for a $100 Western Union money order. The reason the prices are so low compared to what you would expect to lose if your credit card was stolen, or your bank to lose, is because turning these credentials into money is not a trivial process. You're going to lose a lot of money on the way. If someone has to physically go in, use a fake credit card into a store, that's very high risk. Yeah, that person's going to want a lot of money in addition to do that. So there's lots of middlemen. There's whole economies built around this. And so it's surprisingly much a bulk business, more than you would think. It's not something where you're making reams and reams of money, even though the damage to you if your credit card gets stolen is probably a lot more than 10 bucks. And someone earlier mentioned using spyware and blackmail. And so there have been famous cases of this. So probably the most famous is a Miss Teen USA was the victim of someone who had installed software for activating her webcam and took incriminating photos and tried to get her to pay not have them not released. Didn't work out for him. This is something that people have done in software, and malicious software is installing these remote control things and trying to extort people. Sort of a different category way to make money off your malware. So very personal. And then we have the impersonal. So flooding websites. So who remembers October 2016, a lot of websites went down? Yeah, so that was a denial of service attack, which was done by malware. So people had these malicious programs, a worm basically, that ran on cheap devices, and attacked a DNS provider, which was used by a whole lot of companies. And that seemed to just be a we don't like you sort of thing, but this is also something that people make money off of. So there are people who extort money with DDoSs. This is a headline from one of them getting arrested. And basically their way of operating is they send a threat letter to a business, say, your website's going to go down, and they do a demonstration, and if they don't pay, they do more, or maybe not. And Bitcoin is mentioned because that's a convenient way for them to get paid without the peskiness of trying to figure out how to actually get money from without getting in trouble. And this is actually pretty old. So the reports of this going back to like 2004, 2003, and the most common targets back then were people who ran gambling websites in countries where that was legal. So if you're in Antigua and running a gambling website, which is legal in Antigua, you really need your overseas customers, so you really need your internet connection to work, and so you were a big target for these DDoS people. You also have very poor access to law enforcement in like the US or other in major countries. It was a common example. So there are other motivations. So some people just want to do computation, like Morris was trying to do. That's still a motivation for having malware. Have your bunch of machines to do some computation that will make you money. Was briefly mining Bitcoin, so that's no longer even close to profitable. Maybe these days it would be cracking passwords. Would be a thing you would do with a lot of compromised machines. And a lot of people still do it for sort of pride reasons. So some attackers just deface a website. They're not off to make money. So in most of this course, we're not going to talk much about exactly why the malware operators are doing the thing they're doing, how it works. I think it's a very interesting topic. But it doesn't really change what the malware does much. Malware is basically going to do the same thing. Usually it's good not to be noticed. You know, for some of these motivations, maybe that's not true. And they still want to spread. And that's the sort of things we'll be going to worry about this course. But a real strategy that there's real research on is attacking these ways that malware operators make money. Because that's a real way to hurt them. So if you're worried about adware, you can spend one way, and the way thing we'll talk about more in this class is like, how do you make sure web browsers don't have vulnerabilities and things like that? Another thing you can look at is how do those people get paid, and how can we stop them from getting paid? And they're both good areas of research, but in this course, we're basically not going to be talking about that side of things anymore, except if we have time at the end of the semester. So any questions about these motivation things? And why attackers do the things they do? Important categories I missed? Okay, so now I'm going to move on to the part of the class you're probably all waiting for, which is logistics, since it's the first day. So first of all, there's a website. It's linked off Colab. It will have slides, assignments, and lecture recordings when I have batteries. So you should know where it is, you should be able to use it, you probably want to read the assignments, or else you'll probably get a really bad grade in the class. So know about lectures and attendance. I recommend coming to lecture. I will not be taking attendance, and I will be recording lectures. So do with it what you will. I should also mention prerequisites. So technically, if you look at the course catalog, the prerequisite for this course is 2150. And I will not try to enforce more prerequisites than are in the course catalog. However, CS3330 will be very helpful. So if you do not take CS3330, you are allowed to take this course, but you should expect to have to do a bit more work. In particular, there are things from CS3330 that we're going to care about in this course. The big one is that in 3330 you get a bit more familiar with x86 assembly than you were in 2150. And we're going to do a lot of stuff with assembly and machine code. The other one, which is less important, is that we will be doing things which touch on exceptions in virtual memory, but not in much detail, just at a very high level. So that will be a little easier for people who have seen that before in 3330. But it shouldn't be a big deal because we're not going to go into depth on how either of those things work. And if you haven't taken 3330, you probably don't know what those are. But we'll get to that when we get to them. Okay, so there are assignments in this class. So there's going to be a lot of approximately 1 week long assignments. Also, there are two midterms. Their dates are listed on the website, and there is one final. So if you can't make any of these midterms or the final, or you need accommodations for these, any of these midterms or the final or any of the assignments, tell us as soon as possible, please. We're happy to help, and it's much easier to help if we know, you know, a week beforehand and not like the day of an exam. Should also mention textbook. There is no required textbook. So I'm basing this course off the course that Jack Davidson has taught in the past, and he's followed Zor's The Art of Computer Virus Research and Defense heavily. So if you have that book, it should be a very good reference. I will probably be using some material that is not in that book because I have slightly different opinions on what this course should cover. And I can also recommend general security books, which this is not. This is very much about malware or not. More general computer security. So TAs, we have TAs. I don't think any of them are here, but they're posted on the website. We will have office hours probably starting next week. My office hours are posted on the website. I have office hours on Friday, and tentatively Monday, Wednesday, Friday going forward. I'll see if my schedule changes so I can do that or not. So there's a Piazza. That's a place to ask questions. Please use it. I will monitor it. I also have anonymous feedback on Colab. It's almost always appreciated. Some of you have already discovered it. Thank you very much for correcting major typos. And I may or may not read it like Luther does, but to the class, but I will read it myself. Okay. And some miscellaneous things that I have to mention. If you have exceptional circumstances of any kind, please ask. I'm very accommodating, really. There's a late policy, it's on the website, you can look it up. Assignments are individual. I don't think I need to say that because you'd assume that, so don't cheat. If you're not sure something is cheating, please ask. Okay, now a less more heavy topic on ethics. So we're talking about exploits and evil software, and you could use the techniques in this class to do evil things. Don't. I shouldn't need to tell you this, but don't. But I want to be a bit stronger than that. Don't use someone's computer without your permission or in excess of what they've permitted of you, what their reasonable expectations are. Don't do it just if it's a prank. Really don't. And don't assume that it would be okay. If you're not willing to ask, it's probably not okay. And if you aren't motivated by your pure ethical love, then you should note the law, that it's probably illegal to access computers without authorization. You probably knew that. It's probably illegal to deliberately overload the service, like happened in October 2016. It's probably even illegal to do things which you might reasonably think are ethical, like backhacking into someone who's operating malware. That's probably illegal, a federal crime. Deploying a worm to patch security holes, probably illegal. So don't do it. Don't think of doing it. And out of an abundance of caution, we have an ethics pledge, which I will have copies of here, that one of your assignments is to please read and sign. It's also on the website if you want to print it out yourself. I'll have copies after class. To read and sign, if you aren't willing to agree to that, we should talk. It's probably not a good thing, but we should talk. So that's one piece of homework that I would like that by a week from Monday in class or my office hours, whenever it's convenient. The other big piece of homework is that we want you to get a VM working. So that's the first assignment. It's due a week from Friday. I assume many of you have done this before. There's one bit of pickiness, that we want you to get a 64-bit Linux VM. So we want exactly this because our assignments are going to do things like use memory addresses and executables on the system, which will change if you don't have a matching system. So you need to have exactly this at your disposal. So 64-bit, and there's a tiny possibility you can't do that. That your machine doesn't have 64-bit support. I think that is unlikely, but there are systems that are plausible for you to have that are pretty old, but plausible for you to have on your laptop where there's no CPU support. Not just it's hard to set up, where you can't do it. If you have this situation, please find out as soon as possible and come to us. We have some alternative solutions if you run into this. And so the assignment for setting it up also tells you to do some things on the VM and give us a screenshot to show that you probably did them. It's due a week from Friday, as I mentioned. Submitted on Colab. You should be able to do it. And please try to find out early if you're going to have technical problems so we can try to resolve them before the next assignment, where it would probably be helpful to have the VM working. So that's what I have for today. So next time we're going to talk about VMs in general and how they interact with malware, because they're both useful for investigating malware and something that malware actually cares about, as it turns out. And later on in the semester, we're going to go through a bit of assembly review and talk about that cat and mouse game, techniques that malware used to hide from anti-malware software and ways anti-malware software works. And then that's like the first third of the semester, depending on how fast we go. And then we're going to talk a lot about software vulnerabilities, mostly memory management related, how you exploit them, how we defend against them, how we defeat those defenses, and some bonus topics like safe languages and browser security, depending on time and interest. And so that's what I have for today. So if you'd like to pick up a hard copy of the Ethics Plus rather than print it out, come down. Other questions? Come on down.